Welcome to the newest podcast in the MGO blog lineup. I'm Seth Fisher. I'm going to be here with Dr. Sapp, and this is called The Teams. We're going to be talking about a different Michigan team every episode, starting with the one famous for getting a linebacker yelled at. So here we are. We're starting a new podcast covering Michigan history. I've got Steve, Dr. Sapp, Sapper Dana sitting here with me. We are sponsored by HomeSure Lending. If you're buying or refinancing your home, you should give Matt Demarest a call. He loves working with Michigan fans, and he's going to make your loan really easy. Anyway, the idea is we're going to pick one season every podcast to talk about. We'll go through the Michigan great seasons. We'll also go through some not great seasons. Try to get the whole Michigan history down. It's going to take us a while.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a good segment.
Yeah, we've been talking about doing this for years. And it really started, I think, with your article in Hail the Victors 2016 on the Sixpenny defense,
right,
and the 1980 team. So we decided that had to be the team we start with.
Right. That was a special year, special team, and one of Bo's best teams, maybe one of the best all time in Michigan football history, which I think, to your point, is kind of the impetus for this whole podcast series. Because it's great to look back and really now understand how good was that year, or how good was that team relative to the other great teams down through the line in Michigan football history.
Well, I think, too, when you have a greater perspective. Now, I was 0 years old in 1980. I was born in the last 6 days in 1979. So my 1980 was probably a little different than yours.
Right, because I was there holding the banner proclaiming Purdue's doom in that game.
Which was prescient. We'll get to that. But, you know, the more history you know, the better I think you can take the present and the better perspective you have on the present. Right. So when you look at Michigan today and try to say, you know, what does the 2018 team look like against some of the teams in the past, you get a lot better perspective of where we are and, you know, what actually does make Michigan so great.
Right. So to that point, before we start talking about 1980, let's kind of look at where they came from, right? And that was the ashes of the 1979 season.
Right, which I made a point before we started recording that that was kind of the 2017 to the 2018. That was the young team. They'd replaced a lot of starters, and they were kind of changing the direction of the offense, and kind of, they lost some of their coaches in the offseason too. So
right.
You should talk more about
and
that.
That was just tough to take. I mean, you had been to three straight Rose Bowls, right? 76, 77, 78. And you're just thinking, well, we're just going to reload and, you know, plug and play again in 1979. And my gosh, that wasn't the case at all, right? So now you're losing to teams that you've never really lost to. And you've lost three games in a row to end the season. And then you lose the Gator Bowl. My gosh, the Gator Bowl to a basketball school.
Right.
I mean, that was just, it was unfathomable, dude. It was just, it was tough to take.
And the way that season fell apart in November is recognizable to Michigan fans today, but certainly was not something they were accustomed to back then.
Right, because you always won in November. They were basically, well, they were undefeated in November for those last 2-3 years, right? So
when they lost, it was to Ohio State because of some.
So 79 was tough, and then you get into 1980, and now you recognize that you don't have a quarterback.
Yeah. Well, they lost five guys right before the season started, right? Bo kicked five guys off the team for something that we'll say is legal as of a couple weeks ago.
Well, and that's the thing. Back then, that was unheard of. How does any Michigan football team have any disciplinary issues to the point where it's now visible and published that you have guys that are no longer on the team? Again, that stuff had been kept sort of underneath, had been swept underneath the carpet, right? But now it was out there. Like, right. These guys are off the team.
Well, I mean, if you could zoom back a bit and look at the college football in a greater sense, television was starting to become a bigger thing. Now, I know 1984 is the real takeoff point because of the court case, but
ESPN's out there now.
Yeah, so you're getting a changing landscape. There's a lot more money starting to be involved in the game. And kicking five guys off your team is not just a decision about your football team. This is a financial decision that affects the entire university.
Right.
So I mean, you could say Bo was old school. Bo was sticking to his... Bo had a certain type of program that he wanted to have. And I think one of the reasons he was able to, for the most part, reload and continue to be one of the best coaches for years after in this new changing landscape was that he stuck to his guns. But I'm sure he was questioning it, especially in the 1979 offseason and going into the 1980 season when, and then they start right off with two losses.
Right,
you start 1-3 in the first games.
You barely beat a Northwestern team, which
and Northwestern was, until I was a teenager, Northwestern was a walkover.
They were the Rutgers of the conference, maybe of the college football world. They were bad.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Rutgers actually has less history with football than Northwestern does.
Dude, they were so bad. Northwestern was so bad. To paint the picture for everybody, they recognized that they were going to make more money playing at Michigan than they would have in front of 20,000 fans in Evanston. So instead of playing home games, they would play Michigan at Ann Arbor back-to-back years. That's how bad they were. Think about that for a second.
Yeah, which is something Indiana's done recently. But yeah, so Northwestern, they struggle, and then they go into Notre Dame and lose on a last-second field goal into the wind from 53 yards.
Yeah,
supposedly the wind. I think you've had some choice words to say about
it. You know, the wind supposedly stops, and the ball barely does barely clear the crossbar. So it's a, improbable.
But was Michigan
ending.
Outplayed? Because that was a big-time Notre Dame program.
Yeah.
They were kind of falling off at that point, too, right?
Yeah, they weren't really outplayed. I think it was just a classic game in South Bend. It goes back and forth, right? It was momentum swings, turnovers, and then Bo finally recognizes, literally in that game, that he's got to go with not only John Wangler at quarterback, but there's a titanic shift in philosophy in my mind where he recognizes that we have to go to a power offense.
Right. So I mean, they're coming off the mid-70s when they had Rick Leach and they were running the option every play. And even in 79 when they beat Indiana and they have that amazing pass to Carter, there is a play action.
There's still running play action because you got to freeze the linebackers.
Because they don't have – I asked Wangler about this before. They didn't have anything in the playbook. They didn't have a non-play action pass in the playbook in 79. And you're talking about an age now where the pass is really taking off. In fact, Michigan played some of the best passers of the year – or in the game that year.
That season, correct.
Right.
So yeah, that's finally where Bo recognizes that we've got the – even though we recruited for an option offense – we've got the O-line that can dominate and blow guys off the line of scrimmage, right? You still have the good technique. You still got Jerry Hanlon coaching them. But now, Bo always wanted the defenses to account for the Michigan quarterback and defend him. So that was his hesitancy because now if you have a pocket passer, they're going to put another guy in the box that your quarterback will now basically be unblocked.
Right.
And Bo hated that. But now when you have Anthony Carter on the outside, teams have to decide, am I going to double cover Carter or am I going to put that other guy in the box?
Yeah. And the other, I mean, they had, I don't want to just say like they woke up one day and all of a sudden decided to go passing because they already had Bubba Paris and Ed Moransky on the two tackles. Both those guys are tall and very different. Bo used to never have a guy over 270.
I just said, they're always 6'6", 275.
Right, right. And Bubba and Ed had to do a lot of work
to stay
on the scales at Shem Beckler Hall to stay under the Bo weight limit.
Yeah. Okay, so now they understand how to win and who they're going to win with, and it's going to be Wangler, and it's not just his skill set, but it's also his character and his leadership abilities, because now he's one of those fifth-year guys, and he's now the guy that the team rallies around. This guy has come back from injury, right? They never thought he'd run, let alone play again. Think about that for a second. So
right.
He becomes now the sort of emotional leader of the team, whether he likes it or not. He's not a very vocal guy, but nonetheless, he's the quarterback. So now they understand that they're going to go with a power game, and Wangler is going to be the QB. And that's a monumental shift for Bo and for Hanlon because they love their option offense, right?
Right, and they've been coaching this for years. I mean, what's the old adage? Bo doesn't throw. And now all of a sudden... you know, they're not going to be a totally passing offense, but they're certainly not a run option every play offense anymore.
But this is also one of Bo's mantras that rings through down through the years. I want someone who's going to protect the football and not make mistakes. And typically, that comes with age, meaning a fifth-year guy. You're not going to get a hotshot freshman out of college who's going to
out of
act
high school,
like a
yeah.
fifth-year senior.
Right.
He's going to do things that he used to do in high school, and you can't do that anymore.
The guys running the ball weren't exactly bums either. I mean, they had Stan Edwards at fullback still. That's Braylon's dad. They had Troy's dad, Butch Wolfolk, and Lawrence Ricks. And all those guys were, you know, some of the better running backs in the conference, at least.
Right. Yeah. And then they also had, they had Rich Hewlett as the returning quarterback.
Yeah.
Right, from 1979. But then they also had the hotshot phenom in Steve Smith.
Right.
And everybody, because of course everyone wants the backup quarterback, and evidently he was going to be the guy coming out of spring ball because Wengler hadn't even practiced.
Right.
But he hurt his shoulder. So Hewlett gets the nod, and then that's when, you know, they barely beat Northwestern. Hewlett struggles against Notre Dame, and things kind of stabilize with Wengler.
Okay. So even though he's the guy who threw the pass to Anthony Carter the year prior, Johnny Wengler is at best the third guy they're expecting to start a quarterback.
I wrote a story about it that he was literally the first quarterback to wear a red shirt because Bo wanted, he did not want his quarterbacks to be prima donnas. He wanted them to be able to take a hit, and he wanted to see if they could get up. And Wengler was the first guy where he basically said, hands off.
Yeah.
And that was a big change for Bo. So now, in his 11th year, Bo is changing, and that's kind of surprising because Bo is stubborn, right?
Right.
You know, you're not going to change Bo, but he recognizes that, my gosh, 1979 was just a mess, right? Things have got to change. I remember Lloyd Carr telling me that the way they fixed the kicking game was that Bo gave a position to every coach on that kick team and mm-hmm. said, this is your assignment. You are going to coach that position, that player, that position, and I don't want any breakdowns. How crazy is that? And then they led the nation in net kicking, I believe it was that year, 1980. A complete reversal from the debacle that 1979 was.
So let's talk a little bit about the coaching staff, because we mentioned them already. In the offseason, they lose defensive backs coach Jack Harbaugh. He becomes the defensive coordinator at Stanford. He was also one of their best recruiters.
Oh, correct. And he actually set the tone for the hard-hitting secondary. He told the guys, you're going to make these guys pay.
They also had to change their coverage strategy up a little bit. Michigan had always been kind of a cover high three, keep everything in front of you, and play within your scheme defense. And they didn't have any safeties, so they kind of had to go to a simpler cover two, or what we would call today a quarters defense.
Yeah, it wasn't as predominant as it is now. They would mix things up, but they did like their zone because invariably, when they went out west and played these hotshot California schools, these California quarterbacks would carve them up because they're playing a soft zone because they want to keep everything in front of them.
So throughout the 1970s, Bo has this cover three defense with a hybrid safety that he called the Wolfman, pretty much analogous to what a Viper is today. And Lloyd Carr, the new defensive backs coach, has to scrap that because his marching orders from Bo are don't let anybody get behind the defense. And we should talk a little about Carr because another guy they lost was Don Nealon.
Correct, and he's critical too.
Right. So Don Nealon takes the head coaching job at West Virginia, and he asks Gary Moeller who he should get for his secondary coach, and Moeller recommends Lloyd Carr. So he hires Lloyd Carr. Carr gets to West Virginia. Has a cup of coffee, and then gets a call from Bo Schembechler, who needs to replace Jack Harbaugh, and says, Gary says, I gotta hire ya.
And Nealon gives him his blessing, because, and I talked to Don Nealon a few years ago, and he just thinks the world of Bo. And I'm sure he told Lloyd, listen, that's Bo.
Yeah.
You gotta take that job.
Right, so, and the last guy they bring in is Bo's former defensive coordinator, Gary Moeller himself, who has to take over quarterbacks because in Gary Moeller's old job is Bill McCartney.
Divine Child.
Yeah.
Divine Child.
Right? Yeah.
So that's an interesting story real quick about Mac. Bo brings in Mac because Bo wanted a couple of Mac's high school players. How about that? So everyone thinks, oh, no, this is a Jim Harbaugh thing. Actually, it was a Bo thing that was done years ago where to get the players, let's get the coach first.
Ron and his brother were coaching together at Divine Child, and I think his brother is probably still kicking himself for letting Bill go and take all the credit. But Bill was an amazing coach. He was the Don Brown of his day, as evidence about the fact that he went to Colorado and won a national championship afterwards. And he was also an important coach, like Don Brown, for that era because offense was changing. And Mac really knew how to put together a pass defense, and Michigan was far from the only school that was really kind of embracing the pass this year.
Correct, and that's huge, and that's what Lloyd said when he got there in 1980, that they were running a quarters defense.
Yeah.
And he said he needed another safety.
Right.
Because they only had one. And he told me that he plucks a wide receiver.
Right.
To be his safety. And that just shocked me. But he told it was Tony Jackson. He said, listen, Tony, I know you want to be the next Anthony Carter, but let's be realistic here. You're not going to get on the field ahead of Anthony Carter. And we also have Alan Mitchell, and you're not going to beat out Alan Mitchell. So if you want to see the field, you might as well come on defense and be my quarterback of the defensive secondary.
Yeah, Tony Jackson says that Carr asked him, when's the last time we passed in practice?
So that's big because that's a recruiting tactic that Bo wants to see if Lloyd can do, because Bo basically told Lloyd, well, if you want that guy, go recruit him.
Yeah.
Go recruit him to the defensive side. And he does.
Yeah.
And he ends up being critical to that 1980 defense.
Right. So they got Miriam Boddy and Carpenter at cornerbacks. And then the other safety is Keith Bostick, who's another guy they kind of had to recruit from offense.
Quarterback transfer. So here's another guy. So this guy was a quarterback. And they convert him to be a corner. Again, you're just like, what are these coaches thinking, right? But they're seeing something there that these kids, or obviously we as fans don't see, right?
Yeah.
That's why.
Well, also, and this is something that kind of resurfaces in the 2000s, they were recruiting option quarterbacks throughout the 70s. So those are guys that, you know, if they're not working out at quarterback, you can still use them all over the field.
Correct. Correct. Correct.
I don't want to get us too off topic here, but it was just way more common back then for players to have to learn a new position once they got to college. Talent was just a lot more spread out in high schools, and the best player at your high school would be the running back or the quarterback. And so that's what most of the guys coming to play a skill position in college were in high school, and then they had to learn a position like safety or cornerback once they got to college and were competing against much higher talent.
And I think the scholarship rule was changing. I think it had dropped down to 95 back
right.
then. And,
yeah.
And Bo made a big deal about that. I don't know if it was exactly 1980, but I remember him making a big stink saying, oh, you know, 95, this is horrible. because he couldn't stockpile.
Yeah.
You know, and Woody couldn't stockpile. But, you know, for the better of the game, that's where it was moving. But to your point, it was becoming now more of a passing game.
Yeah.
Right? And they had all the quarterbacks lined up. They were going to face 5 or 6 prolific passers.
Including Purdue, whose quarterback Mark Herman was entering the 1980 season already the leading passer in NCAA history.
Coached by Jim Young, Bo's former defensive coordinator.
Yeah, and Sir would not look the same as a modern one, but they were running what really was the one of the first shotgun offenses.
It was a deep shotgun and sometimes yeah. no backs.
Right, and they set up with both running backs in front of the quarterback, so there was just no way they were going to run out of this formation. And so to counter that, that week, Bill McCartney invents the dime defense. This yeah. is what you wrote your article on.
The Wednesday, that's what shocked me. On the Wednesday
right.
of that week's practice, he realizes that this is how I'm going to stop them. And he told me he had a vision, right? He had this...
Yeah, this is a very good John Falk story, and I can't do it justice like he can. But according to Falk, Mac comes to Bo and says, I had this vision last night where the Lord told me how to stop Purdue. He draws it up, and Bo looks at it, and he looks at it again. And Bo says to him, Mac, let me tell you one thing. You can run this defense, but it doesn't work. You better hope that the Lord is hiring on Monday.
Yeah, and it's just a great... So Bo yes. is a great CEO.
Yeah.
You've always heard that, but this is really true because... He let his coaches coach.
Yeah.
Right? And he liked to coach coaches. And that's what they say great leaders do. You will coach your coaches and let them do their job, right? But just sort of stay high level with them. So what he told Mac is that, yeah, we can run this, right? But my gosh, if it doesn't work, you're done. Right?
Yeah, we'll put this in. If it doesn't work, you're fired.
You're toast.
Yeah.
There's the Michigan replay segment where he says, you know, hey, we talked about it before the game. And he said, my gosh, if they run, you know, we weren't going to panic.
Right.
Right. But that was Bo's biggest fear, is that they would gash them on the ground.
Yeah.
And that was Bo's worry. Like, hey, you have to be able to run the ball and stop the run. So if they couldn't stop the run, how would you then adjust your defense? But as it turned out, Canavino, I don't know if you know this, Canavino never left the field that game. So every single play.
Right. So this isn't the terminology that they used back then. But if you want to picture this, Michigan's defense in 1980, their base defense was a 3-4. And what they did was replaced one of the middle linebackers. They leave in Canavino. They take out Gergash, who was like the weak side linebacker. And they also took out one of the defensive ends, what they would call a tackle, replaced them with two defensive backs. So they end up with two defensive tackles flanked by two outside linebackers / defensive ends, you know, rush guys. And then one linebacker in the middle and six defensive backs. And just to give you an idea of how modern this is pretty much exactly what Wisconsin today would run on a 3rd and 17.
And then they move, but here's a great thing. They move Bostic, who was a safety.
Right.
They moved him up to basically be, is he the Mike now?
Yeah, they would say a Sam. We would say a Viper.
Sam.
Yeah.
So that, but that's what confused Mark Herman, because he would see the same personnel, essentially, but they were in different spots. But what the beauty of it was, Mac recognized what the go-to play was and who the go-to guy was for Purdue. And that was their big tight end, Dave Young.
Okay.
Right? And then, of course, he had the great running back, Jimmy Smith. So he wanted to neutralize and negate those two. And the way he did that is he moved Bostic up closer to the line of scrimmage to cover Young.
Right.
And then Canavino had responsibility on Jimmy Smith. So the great thing was, early in the game, there's a dump pass to Jimmy Smith coming out of the backfield. And Canavino collides with him. And it's this head-to-head collision.
Right.
And he literally sets – they both fall backwards, because the collision was so violent. And Smith is still kind of groggy and kind of dazed. Canavino gets up and is literally like talking down to him, basically like, you know, taunting him, right? He's like, you know, you don't want any part of me, right?
Right.
And the tone was set like that. And when something happens like that, it's almost like the...
Dadrian Taylor?
Yeah.
The Dadrian Taylor hit. But, you know, it's important to point out that, you know, today we have targeting and they're trying to get these things out of the game, and rightly so. But back then, that was very much a part of the game.
And I'm going to intimidate you physically by the way I hit you.
All right, and I want to put it out there just because, you know, when you do history, there's a tendency for people just to imagine everyone in the past were barbarians. The helmets back then were not nearly as good as today.
My gosh.
And this was a real limiting factor, because if you decided to hit somebody helmet to helmet, you are literally taking your life in your hands. And that's a decision that, I mean, it's not like guys didn't do it. But when you did it, if you want to send that message, the message is that I don't care if I die.
Yeah, you felt it.
Yeah, on the other hand, the culture of football was, it's worth it to lose a few brain cells to stop a first down or to send a message.
Whereas Don Cherry liked to say in hockey, you could waste one. Waste one on the goalie. But anyways, that tone, that hit sets the tone for the game. And I was there as a 16-year-old kid, and I was just amazed that my jaw was just dropped. Yeah. Like, I can't believe we're just owning these guys.
All right, so what Bill McCartney said was the key was actually Mel Owens, who was the... today we would call it a weak side defensive end, like Chase Winovich's role. Back then, they called it outside linebacker. It's the same thing. But Owens was going up against not only the left tackle, but often a running back who was set up in the backfield to stop him, and possibly a tight end, but the tight end was usually on the other side from him. But so Owens really was the guy who had to get pressure and sometimes beat not just one but two guys and make sure that he was getting to the quarterback with regularity, and he did. And I think what's fascinating from the standpoint of football history is this game was the moment that the shotgun offense met
the problem with the shotgun offense, that you need to have outlet passes built in, you need to have hot routes, you need to have the quarterback making a lot of extra reads, because if he's getting under pressure from an outside linebacker rushing with his ears back, you need to be able to get rid of the ball. And Purdue's offense just didn't have that yet, because the shotgun offense didn't have it yet.
It got to him, right, with only three or four-man rush.
All right, so in the first half, Purdue gets like one good positive play, and it was a play that Lloyd Carr said that they had scouted, but because they installed this defense on Wednesday, they just didn't have time to install that one play. And in the second half, they get it installed, and they shut them down.
Shut them down. No first downs.
Yeah.
That's an amazing thing when you think about that. No first downs for the entire second half.
Against one of the best offenses in the country.
And the most prolific passer in NCAA history.
Okay, so step back and let's just do a quick overview of the season. They start the season ranked number 12, but their first three games are terrible. They have a very tight win against Northwestern, who back then was just absolutely miserable. And then they go to Notre Dame and they lose by two. Then they lose to South Carolina at home. And you know, they get the ship turned around, but now they're unranked. They beat California 38-13. Michigan State's a tight game, 27-23. And Minnesota's 37-14 on the road. That's a solid win, but that game was a little closer than it needed to be until the end. But then they just come and blow the doors off of Illinois in late October. And my theory is, and we're going to talk to Andy Canavino later, so I'm going to ask him about this. My theory is that that was about Gary Moeller.
Well, because it happened again in 1981 when he put 70 on him.
Yeah.
So I would love to hear what Andy has to say about that. But to set the stage, back then, Michigan did not have a good record on grass.
Okay.
Throughout the 70s. So what if, of course, they play at Notre Dame on grass, they lose, right? So now their next game on grass is out west against California on grass. And you're thinking, well, this is it. This is your classic game that Michigan loses. It's on grass. It's out west.
My generation, all you have to say is out west. You know, there's the UCLA game that John Navarre started. There's Oregon.
Then you know, Washington. Right?
Yeah.
It didn't matter who you played.
Anytime we went out there, it was a disaster.
But they find a way to win that game. They shut down their great passer, Campbell. And all of a sudden now you're kind of like, this team's pretty good, but there's still some sort of doubt, because now they're just, what, are they 3-2 at this point?
Right, and then we hit the three games that people in 2015 might remember. We were talking about the 1980 team, because they get three straight shutouts. Indiana, who was not a good team, and Wisconsin, I know it's hard to believe for anyone who's been around college football the last 20 years, but before that, Wisconsin just used to be a drag. So going to the, yeah, they went there, right? They winning 24-0 was not actually that big of a deal.
They were bad for a while, and that particular game, I remember that game, not only was it very windy, but there was a tremendous amount of crowd noise back then, to the point where Wengler, it literally took him, I kid you not, 30 minutes to snap one play.
Oh, my God.
They went through all of their timeouts. And Bo just told Wengler, you just stand there with your hands on your hips. This is 1980, right? And that's what Bo told all of his quarterbacks to do.
Okay.
And that's what he did. And the crowd was just raucous, because it's Madison.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that was crazy.
And then they've got to go into Ohio State.
Yeah, but even that game, you know, it reminded me of what I felt like this year. It's like, you're going to Columbus, you don't know what's going to happen, right?
And once again, Ohio State is a complete juggernaut.
Right. They were undefeated in 1979 with Earl Bruce.
Yep.
Right? They lost the Rose Bowl by 1 point.
Yep. And then they've got a Heisman candidate quarterback in 80.
Right?
Yep.
A thrower. Another great thrower.
Right.
And you're thinking, well, this, you know, this is it. You know, you're going to lose. But then you had 1-76. You had 1-78. And you're thinking, can you do it again in 1980? And then, of course, Ohio State and their infinite wisdom, they shut the water off in the hotel room for the team before the game. You know, I remember you for making the big deal about it on the broadcast, but I think that only solidified the team and only brought them together.
Yeah.
And it's just another great defensive performance, because once again, the offense scores enough points to win.
Yeah.
Right? Not a lot, 9 points.
Yeah, and I know it's kind of insane to look at now, but people back then were no different than today, and people were talking about Bo and has the game passed him by, and that was another important win for him to go undefeated in the Big Ten, and now nobody remembers the Notre Dame game anymore.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of people forget that Ohio State had the ball right in the very last few seconds, and you're thinking, well, they're going to score a touchdown and win the game and beat us 10-9, right?
Yeah.
But the game ends with a sack and an incomplete pass. And
I was probably thinking I need a nap at that time.
So, but you're on pins and needles because it's Columbus, it's Ohio State, and you just never know what to expect. So, yeah, they win that game, and what a huge sigh of relief. Like, wow, we're actually outright champs.
Yeah.
Right? You're not – it's no co-championship here. You're the outright champs, and my gosh, you're going back to California.
And speaking of 1980 narratives that wouldn't be out of place today, nobody could stop talking about how Bo had never won a bowl game.
So, yeah, think about it. His first 11 years, he lost – every last game of the season. Think about that for a second. Not just the bowl game. He either lost to Ohio State or he lost the bowl game. So for 11 straight years, never won the last game.
Well, they tied once. Yeah.
Awful. Think about it now. Think about that now. If it was 11 years.
Right, and this is a thing you learn about people from having a message board. They only remember the last game.
How it ended.
Right. You know, and just like today with Harbaugh, fans who are living through this aren't really appreciating that you have one of the better coaches in college football when they've got Bo for the first 10 years and he's winning all these games, because at the end of every season, you are just thrown right back into the black pit of negative expectations. Until this one.
Well, and that's why this team and this season is so sort of, it's a watershed mark, in my opinion, for Bo and his teams, because now I think he's got the recipe to win out West.
Yeah.
Right. So Bo does get his victory. They go to they go to Pasadena and they beat Washington 23-6. And now Bo is one of the premier coaches in college football. And, you know, now we're going to be fending off Texas A&M for to keep him and whatnot in the coming years. I want to pause here. And we're going to go and talk to Andy Canavino, maybe get the Andy Canavino story from somebody besides John Bacon for once. And then after that, I think we're going to wrap it up by talking about, you know, the team, you know, where it kind of fits in the pantheon of Michigan seasons, and how do we see this team today?
If you're looking for a mortgage and you're a Michigan fan, there's only one place to go: Homeshore Lending. Fair and honest, Homeshore Lending is local, efficient, and small enough that you'll work directly with the owner, Matt Demarest. Matt bleeds maize and blue, and so does his family.
Hi, this is Matt Demarest, owner of Homeshore Lending. We're a local mortgage company based here in Ann Arbor on State Street, but we serve the entire state of Michigan, helping people buy or refinance their homes. We care about doing things the right way and treating people the right way, but we also care deeply about the Wolverines, and I wanted to introduce you to a couple of the biggest Michigan fans I know.
Hi, I'm Cooper. I'm 10.
I'm Colby, and I'm 8.
Who's the best team in the whole country?
Michigan!
Homeshore Lending at 2723 South State Street in Ann Arbor. For more info, go to homeshorelending.com. That's HOMESHORELENDING.com. Or call Matt at 734-531-9950. Homeshore Lending. NMLS number 1161358. Equal housing lender.
So I'm really excited about this segment where we interview Andy Canavino, who is the middle linebacker, senior captain on the 1980 football team, and also the subject of one of John U. Bacon's favorite stories to tell about Bo Schembechler. You'll hear the story a little bit later. Unfortunately, we lost the beginning of the interview. It was just kind of the introductions, but we had a couple sound issues. I got some new podcasting equipment for this podcast, and we didn't quite know how to make all of the phone stuff work yet, so I'm sorry we lost the intro. You're really not missing anything, and I'm sure the content of this segment is going to be worth some of the little quality issues that came up. Anyway, here's Andy Canavino. Enjoy.
Okay, so let's talk about heading into the season. You know, 79 was a disaster. You get picked as captain, and what's the team sort of attitude going into the season?
Well, there was a couple problems going into the season. Of course, the year before, we had lost our last three games. John Wangler, who was the quarterback, Lawrence Taylor was a defensive end for a defensive linebacker for North Carolina, and John Wengler in the Gator Bowl rolled out Lawrence Taylor, who we all know he is, tackled him, and John had a bad ACL injury, so there was no guarantee John was coming back the following year. Also, and he was going to be our starting quarterback, and he had a great year. Also, Bo Schembechler had thrown five kids off the team in the spring for various issues, and they were all our teammates. They were my in my class. So we were basically very disturbed with the coaches. We're mad about that. We didn't know if John was coming back. So there was a lot of problems going into the season. And also we started the season, I don't know if you want to start that right now, but we started the season 1-2. So Bo was actually 1-5 his last six games at Michigan going into our third game. And, I'll talk about those losses a little bit later if you want. But, so yeah, there was a lot of problems going into that season. And, the other thing was we only had three starters returning on defense. And, we only had three seniors that were going to start on defense. Everyone else was super young, so there was a lot of question marks going into
You lost some coaches, too, didn't you? I think Harbaugh left for Stanford. And...
yeah, what had happened was Jack Harbaugh had left, and another coach that I can't think, but...
Nealon left for West Virginia that year.
Yeah, Don Nealon. And so they brought in Gary Moeller and actually Lloyd Carr my senior year. So Lloyd was going to coach defensive backs, and Gary was going to stay on. He was going to be stay on offense. He was going to be the offensive coordinator with Bo and Jerry Hanlon. So that also was a little. I think just being on the defensive side, we didn't know a lot about the offense. You know what I mean? You really separated. So Gary Moeller probably was a big. I don't know if it was a problem, but it was. You know, you had a. There was a. You know, times you used a new coach on the offense, and defensive side with Lloyd wasn't a big deal because he was coaching the defensive backs.
Right,
but yeah, bringing those two new coaches too was another thing that was a little more difficult.
Well, that's a good call out when you mentioned Bo's record in the last six games. He was 1-5. You're a fifth year senior. You've seen Bo. You've seen the several sides of Bo. Had you ever seen him like he was after that South Carolina?
Well, what happened was. We actually were beating South Carolina 14-0 at halftime. We took the second half kickoff, drove down to the 2-yard line, and now we're going to score, and it's going to be 21-0. And South Carolina had George Rogers, who was the Heisman Trophy winner that year, and all they did was run the ball. They couldn't pass at all.
Right.
So going up 21-0, basically the game would have been over. But what happened was our fullback, and I'm not going to name names because I love him, he fumbled in the end zone. As he crossed the goal line, he fumbled in the end zone. So instead of being 21-0, they got the ball on a touchback on the 20. They drove down 80 yards to score, and instead of 21-0 game over, it's now 14-7. So little plays like that cost us not only undefeated season, national championship, and also then what happened was Bo called the fake punt in our own 40-yard line because he didn't have confidence in our defense. We were very young, like I said, three starters for seniors. We hadn't played well against Notre Dame and Northwestern, and so he called the fake punt. It failed. They scored. We ended up losing the game.
Right.
Anyway,
so
that was not, you know.
Right, and that
and there
sets up
the one side. I don't know. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but there is a story after the one that you said. When we talk about it, where it's called the Andy Canavino story, which is myself when he called me into the office and got me to get into that story after the we're 1-5 our last six games and what happened.
Yeah, that was my introduction to the 1980 team because I've been to a bunch of events with John Bacon, and he loves doing his Bo impression and loves telling the Canavino story. And then one time we're in Cleveland and he's telling the Canavino story, and there in the crowd is Andy Canavino.
Yeah, what happened was there's a lot of factors. Ohio State had fired Woody Hayes. They had hired Bill Bruce. There were articles in the paper how Earl's got a different culture. They love Earl. Woody was too tough. And, Ohio State was undefeated and how they loved him, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, junior year, they went like 11-1. We lost Earl Bruce's first year. Now this is Earl's second year, so now they're undefeated again. So we're reading all these articles, and Bo's got us out there practicing 3-4 hours a night. So I just make a flippant comment. McCartney, our defense coordinator, asked me, what's wrong with the team? And I said, oh, you know, people are complaining. The young kids think we're practicing too hard, blah, blah, blah. So it was really an off-the-cuff comment. Well, one of the coaches heard that besides Mac and told Bo. And Bo called me into his office, and I didn't know, you know, what the problem was. And he sits me down. He basically starts yelling and screaming at me, you're my captain. Don't you ever say our practice is too hard. You want me to call Dan Beardo from Reggie McKenzie and Rick Leach and ask them if we practiced too hard in the past? And he was screaming and yelling and reaching over the desk, and spit was coming out of his mouth. And wow. I was basically, first I was in shock, and then I actually had tears in my eyes. I was actually crying. And I didn't know what to say. And I was trying to get it out that, Bo, it was a flippant remark, you know what I mean? It wasn't, you know, like I was really complaining. I just, you know, Mac asked me what was wrong. I said, oh, you know, people think it's this and that. And he went crazy. He says, you're my captain, and when you leave here, you're going to be me on the field, and we're going to win every game. We're going to go on the field, and we're going to the Rose Bowl because of you, and that's what we're going to do. And, you know, looking back at the time, you know, I did change. I did get more, you know, I was yelling at players, not yelling, but, you know, trying to pump them up, trying to encourage them. I was more vocal after that meeting. And luckily, and I do mean that, we did win every game, won the Rose Bowl. And so Bo actually calls me his greatest captain ever because of it. I'm not sure I'm worthy of that, but it's a good story.
For sure. So what point in the season, Andy, do you realize that you are going to run the table?
Well, what had happened, see, when we played Notre Dame, we actually lost on a 53-yard field goal. The guy kicked the field goal against the wind. The wind actually died down. If you ever listen to Ufer call that game, it's an amazing. The wind actually stopped. He kicked the 53-yard field goal with no time on that clock. We lose. We lose to South Carolina the next week, which we shouldn't have lost. And so actually, you know, our confidence is still high because we still are Michigan. Like, when you're at Michigan, Ohio State, you still believe you can win every game. The defense had to get better. He made a couple changes on the defensive line, and basically, you know, after the Michigan State game, which we won, I think, 26-23, the defense really came together. We had a great offensive line. We had a great line. We had Langler at quarterback. We had Anthony Carter at wide receiver. I think every lineman on the team got drafted, you know, in the first five rounds, you know, in the future. So we knew we had a good team. It was just putting it all together and you know, start winning some games and gaining some confidence for the young kids, especially on defense.
So was it Michigan State where you guys figured hey, we're pretty good, or is it more after
anytime you play them, you know it's going to be a hard-hitting, tough contest. And they came into our stadium, and we actually, I think, won, like I said, 26-23. But after the game, we're like, you know what? You know, they're tough to beat. We can beat anybody. We're good. We're young, but, you know, defense is young. But, you know, we got three great seniors on the defense, and you know, let's get this thing going. You know, John Wanger's healthy now. You know, he was gimping around the first few weeks. You know, we got a healthy John Wanger. We got a great offensive line, and you know, we're ready to go. And we basically said that, and we basically had the confidence to win every game, to be honest.
Okay, so then
the two games we lost, the one thing I want to say, the two games we lost were non-conference. When you lose non-conference, all your goals are still ahead of you. Our goals at the time, and sadly, Bo never really emphasized the national championship back then. It was like, let's win the Big Ten, let's beat Ohio State, let's win the Rose Bowl. So our goals were still in front of us, even though we had lost two games.
Right.
So we were still confident we could do that.
So you're playing all these great quarterbacks, right? Campbell from California, and got Wilson from Illinois, and you got Clifford from Indiana, and then it's Mark Herman for Purdue. I mean,
yes.
Was it really?
Mark Herman was the NCAA passing leader, and then we had Schleese the next week, and then we had Tom Flick from Washington, and Rose Bowl who played in the NFL. All those players are great players. And so there was a lot of passing, and those last 22 quarters, we held those three quarterbacks plus, I think, another game, 22 quarters without a touchdown.
Right, right. So back then, Andy, was it like it is now where every week is a different scheme and different game altogether?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, people don't realize, you know, they call it the running era, you know, passing came maybe in the late 80s, but like I said, you just named three quarterbacks, plus Mark Kermer was NCAA passing leader with over 12,000 yards. Arch Leister was a great passer, and so was Tom Flick. So passing games started coming in a lot. And so, you know, we had to prepare for both the pass and the run. You know, 10 years earlier, 60s, you know, late 60s, early 70s, you know, it was basically run, 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 you know?
Right.
But everything changed for that year. And, you know, we played some great quarterbacks, to be honest, and we shut them all down. And, of course, I give all the credit to Bill McCartney. Defensive coordinator.
When he introduces the six-penny defense to midweek of that game, of the Purdue week.
Midweek. Oh, jeez.
You know, does he have to sort of have you accept it and then pitch it to the rest of the defense, or how did that work?
Well, what had happened was on Wednesday, I guess he went to bowl, and now Mac was, I'm sure you know, Mac was very, very religious. Mm-hmm. You know, he founded the Promise Keepers, and he went to bowl and said, I had a dream. I mean, this is a true story. I had it in the book, too. I had a dream, and I know how to stop Mark Herman. And Bo said, well, what are we going to do? And he said, well, we're going to start 60 defensive backs, and we're going to take out a linebacker and whatever, and Cannavino's going to be going linebacker, and we're going to start 60 defensive backs. And Bo said, well, I hope that dream comes true. If not, you're going to be fired. And of course, but he did say that. But the thing that people don't understand, I try to even tell people today, and I don't know if they believe me, is that in the Detroit news the next day after we won, they had, well, if five defensive backs is a nickel, then six must be the dime. So he literally invented the dime defense.
Right.
I mean, he was a genius. I mean, so they actually had that in the paper. And then after that, they started calling six defensive backs the dime defense, and it's still called that today.
Right.
So I give them a lot of credit for that. And, of course, it worked to perfection, to be honest with you.
But did you guys kind of scoff at that idea, Andy? Because that had never really been run with much prevalence back then.
Well, the thing was, I thought, and even at the time, and I look back, I think of more, I thought McCartney was a genius. And we thought we had the best coaches in the world. I'm being serious, including Bo. So whatever the coaches did, we thought it was right, and we agreed with it. So it really wasn't a big deal, to be honest with you. It might have been a big deal in defensive backfield because they had to kind of change, you know, where they're going to be positioned. You know, you got six guys instead of four guys instead of five, you know. So it might have been a bigger thing with the defensive backs. But for us, we had all the confidence in the world in McCartney and whatever he said. We were gung-ho. Plus, you know, we had just won about, what, five or six games in a row, so we weren't going to question anything he did.
Right. I want to go back a couple games there because, you know, I remember Bo liking to, you know, get his lead, make sure it's over, and then just kind of grind it out. Except that Illinois game where you guys put up 45. What was Bo's problem with Illinois?
Well, one thing, and I believe this, he never did mention this, but if you look back at the tie between Ohio State and Michigan, I think it was 1971 when the athletic director voted against Michigan, he vowed to get back at every athletic director that voted against him.
Gotcha.
And just to give you an example, we played Wisconsin. 4 years I was there. Elroy Hirsch, who actually went to Michigan, believe it or not, went to Michigan for a year or two, and I forget why he transferred. But anyway,
wartime transfer.
He went to Michigan.
Yeah, he went
to Michigan. So anyway, they never scored a point on us, Wisconsin, in my 4 years there. And the point I'm making is Illinois was one of the other teams that voted against. So anybody that voted against, I think he wanted to run the score. He really never said it to us, to be honest with you. But as I look back and I look at the teams he played and what he did, in the back of his mind, he was still mad from, them not voting him in, 7-8 years earlier.
Well, it's probably why Eufer used to say, Elefant, Schembechler, and Eufer never forget. Okay, so let's talk about Ohio State. You guys had won there in 76 and 78, but this is different now. They've got Arch Leister, like you said. They've pretty much been undefeated for basically 2 years other than their Rose Bowl loss. They're a formidable opponent, and they're not a gimme.
And you got to go to Columbus.
Right, and you know what? This is a fact, and I actually just found out this year, being on some of these Michigan websites, I didn't realize this, that we are the last team, so it's 38 years ago, we are the last team, 1980, to go undefeated in the Big Ten and beat Ohio State and Columbus. Think about that. I'm shocked. I'm actually kind of mad that that's true because I can't believe it. So for 19 years, we have not gone undefeated in the Big Ten and beat Ohio State and Columbus. Even the national championship team, 1997, they played Michigan or Ohio State in Michigan, so they didn't have the opportunity. So that's an interesting record. We're the last team to go undefeated in the Big Ten and beat Ohio State and Columbus. So we knew going in there was going to be a tough game. Of course, it's Ohio State's big rivalry. It's for all the money. But we were sky high in confidence. I mean, we're coming off Purdue, shutting them out 26-0. Our offense is clicking. We got John Wangler, Anthony Carter. Our line is amazing. Bubba Paris, Maransky, tackles that both got drafted. You know, Bubba played, you know, 12, 15 years for the 49ers. And we got George Lilge at center. So, I mean, we were pumped up and ready to go. And we had no doubt, you know, we could beat them at Columbus. It wasn't, you know, the offense didn't have a great game, but, of course, the defense came through again, to be honest.
Right, right. Okay, so now it's the Rose Bowl, and you're playing another great passer. And, of course, Bo has never won in Pasadena. Right. How do you guys prepare differently?
Well, people don't understand that when I went out as a freshman, just to give you an example, we didn't have an indoor building. We went to the Rose Bowl for 14 days before the game. You know how that basically what happens is you lose sight of the game. You know what I mean? You get free. Everything's free. You get spending money. And I'm, you know, I'm going to be honest, we have curfews, but yeah, you know, the guys drank, you know,
sure.
And they went out at night and, you know, we still had curfews, but I mean, 14 days, we leave Ann Arbor in the snow. It's 10 degrees. We get off the plane. It's 85 degrees here in Pasadena, California. You're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. You're basically just excited to be there and you actually kind of lose sight of the game. And that's why I almost want the playoffs, which I don't want, but I almost want the playoffs to expand so that some of these teams from out west and down south can come to Michigan or Ohio State in December and play us, okay? Because
they won't even come here in September.
Every bowl game is in warm weather, so we have to go there. We have to travel across country.
Correct.
So anyway, but the reason I'm telling you this, my senior year, they built the indoor building.
Right.
So we went out the week before the game. So number one, it's game week, which means the curfew is a lot earlier. I think we had like a 10 o'clock curfew, number one. Number two, it's game week. Number three, you're a senior. You want to win the game. You want to win Bo's last game. You want to be the first team to win a bowl game for Bo and win a Rose Bowl. So we were more serious, you know. And, you know, so everything was a little different. And that's basically why I think we you know, ended up, you know, first of all, I think we did have a better team. And at the time, and Bo will say that, Bo said this in his book after the game, he thought we were the best team in the country at that time. And he thought in the book, he writes that we were his best team he ever coached.
Right.
At the end of the season, okay? The problem is we had two losses, so, you know, there's some argument there, you know. But he claims at the end of the season, we were the best team in America and his best team that he ever coached at the end of the season.
Right. Now, I know it was an emotional locker room after the game, Andy, but was it emotional before the game?
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, and I really mean this, we did not talk everybody anything about national championships. We just wanted to win the Big Ten, like I said, beat Ohio State, win the Rose Bowl. So we had two of the three goals, and all we now had to do is we wanted to win the Rose Bowl. So basically, I mean, we were excited, but we weren't overly excited. We knew we had a job to do. We knew we were as good or better than them. And we just went out and did it. So, you know, we were, after the game, it was amazing. Bo's first bowl win, his first Rose Bowl win. Literally, and this is kind of crazy, someone actually flipped me champagne bottles as I was walking into the locker room. I understand, you know, college, that's a no-no.
That's
and,
awesome.
We actually had like three bottles of champagne, and three seniors got up. I was one of them. There's pictures of us, and we actually popped champagne bottles. I don't know if Bo was in the room at the time, but I'll never forget that because there's actually pictures of it. And I look back, I go, wow, I can't believe we did that because, you know, in college, that was a no-no.
Sure.
But someone, I don't even know who it was. I still don't know to this day. Someone slipped me these bottles and I walked into the locker room. It was great. It was a great feeling. And we were happy. I mean, I was ecstatic for Bo. I mean, and then, you know, what we went through as juniors and throwing five kids off our team that were my, you know, in my class and starting one and two. I mean, you know, when you climb a mountain, and you get to the top and there's so much adversity and you finally do it, it's a great thing, you know? And you know, so I don't know if we would have won all those games if we didn't start 1-2. Who knows? You know, Bo calls me in his office after that. I wouldn't have been called in. Who knows? You know what I'm saying? You can't really say, but I do wish we'd have won one of them because if we would have won one of them, we would have been national champs.
Yeah, well, it was a heck of a season either way. And, you know, there's – people are not going to stop telling the stories of the dime defense and shutting out three straight opponents. Yep. And the Canavino story,
you know,
as well.
That's a record,
so.
Too. You know, that's a record, too, because I think it was this year's team or last year's team at three shutouts.
2015.
That hadn't happened since 19. Yeah, that hadn't happened since 1980, they said. But that was actually shocking to hear that. I didn't even realize it. I go, wow, we're the last team to do that. So I guess that record was tied, but it still holds up. So that's pretty cool, to be honest.
Yep.
All right. Well, Andy, I can't thank you enough for coming on here with us and talking about 1980. It's been a pleasure.
Let me just say one thing. Go Blue, and listen, for all you naysayers, Harbaugh forever. I'm going to be 11, and I'm going to tell you this right now. If we had a guy that could guarantee us, but there's no one out there that can do that. So Harbaugh forever. God bless you guys, okay? Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Andy.
Anyway, Andy, thank you. Go Blue. So thank you again, Andy Canavito, for coming on with us. We're going to have one more segment here just to kind of wrap up, maybe do a little lightning round and kind of, you know, pick our favorite players from the team and, you know, just place this in the pantheon of Michigan seasons.
Hey, this is Seth from MGO Blog. Like many of you by now, when it was time to refinance my house, I talked to Matt Demarest in Homeshore Lending. Since we had bought only a few years earlier, it was amazing how different the experience was between Matt and our bank. He knows his stuff, gives you and your loan his personal attention, and can shop with different lenders so you're always a priority. We are constantly getting similar feedback from readers who used Homeshore Lending when buying or refinancing a house in Michigan. He knows the mortgage industry well, which becomes a big deal when your loan is as complicated as mine was. If you haven't met him yet, he's tailgating this year with his HemGo bus at the Charity Beer Garden on 327 Hoover. And if you're buying or refinancing, reach out to Homeshore Lending, NMLS number 1161358.
It's the I formation, two wide outs, Donnelly and Williams on the right side. Here comes Donnelly in motion. Sleaster needs 25 yards. Sleaster's being rushed. He can't, and he's dropped, and it is Michigan's ball game. Look at those Wolverines. 13 seconds. It was Bobby Thompson showing his 14th sack. Look at the Wolverines. Look at old General Bo. Bring out the cookies, Nelly. Daddy's coming home with a victory for the third time. Then down here at Ohio State, he did it in 1976, 22-0. He did it in 1978, 14-3. Michigan's going to do it today, 9-3. The Wolverines take over, and they are just 13 seconds away from the sniffing of roses. The roses in Pasadena, California, and the roses down in the Michigan locker room. Oh, I can see those players now. And old Darth Vader Bruce cannot believe that his Scarlet and Gray Legions ate the ball here at Columbus.
Okay, so let's talk about where this team, 1980 team, ranks in the pantheon in the history of Michigan football as, you know, the great teams that we look back on. I know for me, it was a big watershed mark, watershed year for Bo and for just Michigan football in general, because now he finally figured out how to win the last game of the year.
Yeah, and I wasn't alive for the 1970s. I can't speak to like what it felt like, but it's similar in ways to some of the Harbaugh years where the teams were great. They were really competitive through the year. They won some big games, and then because you don't win the last game of the season. Now, they tied one, but I think he didn't ever win the last game of the season, right?
If you were a fan like I was in the 1970s, they had never won the last game of the year.
Right. And as someone who was on a message board on the internet, I can tell you, fans will remember the last game a little too well, and every other game not nearly as well. The feeling from the last game is what sticks.
So to give it some perspective, even the great Bear Bryant, right, that everyone down in Bama loves, right, he lost his first 9 bowl games. Think about that for a second, right? So Bo, it takes him 11 years to finally win his first one, right?
Uh-huh.
But he does it in such a different way, and it's now with a more sort of pro-style offense, right?
Right.
Which is a big shift for him.
Right.
Right. Because he loved him some option football, right?
Yeah.
But he also recognized that you have to win with defense. And in the 1970s, the entire decade, they're the number one defense in the country.
Michigan is. Yeah.
This is like every statistical category, number one defense. Crazy, dude. Not 1 year, not 2 years, the entire decade.
And people still nitpicked. People still said, right? Hey, you're playing soft cover two, everything, you let everything they need
to. You can't win the big game.
You can't go out west and deal with those big throwing quarterbacks. That was a big deal.
You can't win on grass.
Right. In 1980, all of that is over.
Changes, right?
Right.
So that's why I think this team is really needs to be recognized and put up there, because it gets Bo off to Schneid.
Yeah.
But it also makes Bo recognize that I've got to coach differently. Right. I got to play this game differently.
Right. And I know we talked about this in the first segment, but I think that there was a change going on in college football. The money was getting a lot bigger. The television, more games are getting broadcast. Now, that occurs a little bit later. But the NFL was growing, and players are getting into college thinking about the NFL.
And players are wearing white shoes. Oh, good Lord. I mean, and Bo would have none of that, right? He conceded and said, I'll let you have your names on your jerseys, right? But no, Bo, he was drawing the line
and he's still kicking players off the team. Five players he kicked off the team in preseason for poking the smot.
But we are not running the shotgun.
Right. Right?
We're not going to that. I will throw the ball on third down.
Right.
So, that's why it was such a big season for Bo and for Michigan.
Yeah. And it's not just Bo showing that he can adjust. Anthony Carter changed everything, right?
Right. Because now he has the blueprint.
Yeah.
Now he finally has the outside threat that needs double coverage, but yet you've got a stable of running backs. Those three backs each gained over 800 yards that year, 1980, right?
Right.
And then you got a monstrous O-line.
Yeah.
Right? And there's the blueprint for serious success, right? A stable of running backs, big O-line, and a great outside threat.
And that offensive line is something we should talk about, because it's one of the great offensive lines in Michigan history.
Yep.
And you start with Bubba Paris at left tackle and Ed Moransky at right tackle. I don't know if you can name a better off-tackle pair that right. Michigan's had. I may be going back to the 30s or something, and when they had 100 Wisterts on every single team, right. you could get away. But even like Lawan and Schofield, I don't know if they are at that same level that Bubba right. and Ed were.
Yeah, maybe when you had Elliott, Jumbo Elliott, and Huszar in 86, that was pretty good. Clay Miller in 85. You had Skrepinek, right, towards the end of Bo's years. But, to have two bookend tackles
right.
was Bo's dream.
Who were not the kind of tackles that he used to have. He used to have 270-pounder guys. And Moransky told us a story on a podcast before that they had to play with Bo's scales at Schembechler. I want to rehash the story, because they go to the Rose Bowl that year, right? And Ronald Reagan had, I guess, come in and had this whole new program where, like, everyone's going to get fit, and part right. of it was everyone has to, all the players in the bowl games have to get their weight taken. And Ed and Bubba were not thrilled about this, because these are not the home scales. And Bo had a rule. You had to be 265 pounds to play, or 275 pounds.
Yeah, ironically, they're both 6'6", 275, and I thought, how is that possible?
Right. Right. So, but that was part of the changing football dynamic was that you had 6'6 offensive tackles, and that was because Lawrence Taylor, that was a change that happened in the NFL at the same time too, and Lawrence Taylor was the guy who knocked out Michigan's quarterback.
Well, in 1980 was the first year that offensive linemen can now grab and engage during blocking.
Right.
Before it was
all... This is a very visual podcast.
I'm going to start moving chairs here in a second.
But Snap just blocked me, if you can't.
But before, your fists, if you can picture, your fists needed to be in on your chest.
Uh-huh.
Can you believe that?
Yeah.
That's just unheard of now. How can you block like that?
Yeah.
Right? So now you are able to extend your arms as long as they're within the framework of your body, and you can actually grab the opponent's jersey. Crazy, right? But Bo never coached like that. Bo and Hanlon never coached like that.
Right.
So that was the big thing. If you can have now your monsters on the end engage the tackles, there's no way they're getting through.
Yeah. And the other part of that line is they had an All-American center.
Right.
And
Lilja was awesome.
Yeah. And Lilja was he was big. And I ran into this guy recently. I was walking out of the Bo store, and there's a person in front of me, and I'm like, I didn't recognize him, but I was like, this guy played offensive line for Michigan.
And he was a cerebral guy. He's
very
smart guy, and you don't understand how much communication happens on that O-line and where it all starts with from the center.
Especially if you're going to be pass protecting a lot more, because it takes intelligence to do any kind of blocking, and sure. offensive linemen are some of the smartest guys in football because of this. But run blocking is very different. It's responding to what's in front of you and, knowing exactly. It's inside your own mind. Sure. And pre-snap adjustments to set pass protections, that is I guess, I don't know, a different kind of intelligence or a, but it's you see like a complicated mess and you have to like be a general and tell everybody where to go.
For sure.
And Lilja was, I think, one of the first great centers at that.
And here's a great way with how the 1980s season ended. You know, they ends with those 22 and a half quarters of shutout defense, right? Mm-hmm. Goose eggs on the board. But then they go to the Rose Bowl and they don't just squeak by and win on this, you know, horseshoe luck.
Right.
No. They dominate.
Yeah.
They dominate Washington to the point where they don't even score a touchdown.
Yeah.
It's that dominant.
Right. And they did not allow a touchdown in the second half of the season in 1980.
Crazy, right?
And I know, like, the stories that go around are, like, where Canavino gets chewed out. And, you know, that's a great story. And it's nice to, you know, it's nice to have, like, an easy way to remember the team. But this team was really great all the way through. And it was just the vagaries of football, some bad luck in the 70s, creates a narrative. And people believed the narrative until 1980 kind of disproved it. And after that, you have Texas A&M going after Bo. You have people looking at Michigan in the next decade as a premier program. And I think that this is the season that set up the Harbaugh years. I mean, Jim Harbaugh is a recruit the following year, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is what sets you up for all that success in the 80s and gives Bo another decade after his mentor is gone and after football changed and Bo was able to change with it.
It's big. It's rarely do you see a coach change his philosophy, but that was one of the things that Bo recognized, that, you know, I've got to do something different to win, and he did. And so that was great.
Okay. All right, so lightning round. Who is the MVP of this team? Not who Michigan named. Who do you think is the MVP?
Wow. You know, I of course you're going to say Anthony Carter, but okay. I think it goes past Carter. I think it's Wengler.
Okay.
I don't think this team does what it does without Wengler at the pivot.
Okay.
Without him being the guy, because he becomes then the emotional leader.
I'm for that one. I'm going to play the home game here and say Andy Canavino.
You can't go wrong with that.
And like I haven't broken down the games, but having a middle linebacker who can cover as well as he can hit is an important it's one of the most important things in defending the pass. And they played a lot of pass defense, and they had a lot of good defensive backs on that team too, but they were all young. And the reason Canavino was out there with all those dime backs is he could cover as well as any of them. You know, sometimes he needed to do it with a little hard hit instead of just being there. But I think that was a major key to that defense.
I told Canavino that he was he was Von Miller before Von Miller.
Right.
Right. Because he was an every down linebacker. And you think about it now with everything being so situational, right? Situational football, right?
Yeah.
Different personnel for each down and distance. I mean, Canavino stayed out there the entire game.
Yeah.
And that's huge. I mean, he's not just your run-stuffing linebacker, right, that you had in the 70s.
Right.
He could cover. He could drop back. He could pressure the passer.
And that's the thing. When football is changing and if you're going to defend the new things, you're going to need to look at different archetypes. And Canavino, I think, was a different archetype. Just like Devin Bush is the kind of guy that you want out there to defend a spread,
right,
because he cancels a lot of what you can do with a spread. And I think Canavino canceled what you could do with those early passing offenses.
Like the Jimmy Graham tight end, right? The Zach Gentry, that big guy who becomes a cover mismatch.
Yep. Okay, so those are two, and we can say the offensive, defensive MVP or whatever. What team is this one most like? We'll compare this one to another Michigan season.
Well, you know,
over the pantheon of years.
You know, I likened 1980, the 2018 season, to me was very similar to 1980.
I was going to go there too, except the end.
Except the last game of the season. Because you even have an early season loss at Notre Dame. I mean, it could have. And then you even had the previous year where it was such a disaster.
Yeah.
So it was shaping up to be just like 1980 all over again.
Right. But that does change the makeup of the season. Right. Other than that, they were very similar teams. They had great defenses, great defensive ideas.
I'll give you another one. I say 1985 was very similar to 1980.
Okay.
Because, again, they're coming off of a disaster. Yeah. 1984. Right?
Okay.
And now Bo realizes that, you know what, I'm going to throw the ball and I'm going to play with great defense. But yeah, that might be a story for another podcast.
Yeah, and we're going to have over 100 more of these, hopefully. So I think we can wrap it up. The legacy of this team, I mean, where is this? Where do they go after this? I think this is how we like to wrap it up.
Well, I mean, an incredible defense, incredible coaching staff. It sets them up for now. They start the 1981 season for the first time in Bo's career, ranked number one in the country.
Yep.
Crazy.
Yeah. And, I mean, that team would maybe disappoint a little bit, too. But Bo also was able to win another bowl game in the same year. The Blue Bonnet Bowl was in 1981, too.
Day 364, I think it was, or 365.
Yep. And I think we've already kind of established that this set them up. This set the table for the 1980s.
For the 1980s, for sure.
All right, Sap, this was a lot of fun.
Good stuff, man. I enjoyed it.
All right. We want to thank our sponsor, Homeshore Lending, and thank all of you for listening. Hope you enjoyed it and hope that you come to love Michigan history as much as we do.
Go Blue.
Go Blue.
Thank you for listening to the first episode of the Teams Podcast. I'm Seth Fisher with Dr. Sapp. Thank you, Indy Canavino, for coming on with us. And thank you, old General Bo. Lay out the cookies, Millie.